So I remember thinking very primly when I was asked to work on Thick Bit, well, I don't think I know enough swear words. And then again, Armando sort of asked me to do a Malcolm Tucker diatribe, and it all came pouring out of me, this torrent of filth.
Hello, I'm Hattie Crissell. This is In Writing, and that was my guest this week, Georgia Pritchett. Georgia has written for several of the funniest TV shows of the last 25 years. Her CV includes the groundbreaking all-female comedy sketch show Smack the Pony, Armando Iannucci's Westminster satire The Thick of It, which she was just talking about there, another Armando Iannucci show Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus as a narcissistic vice president, and Georgia is also in the writer's room on Succession, so it's quite the CV. When I spoke to her, I hadn't yet seen her latest project, The Shrink Next Door, which is a comedy drama starring Will Ferrell, Paul Rudd and Catherine Hahn, and based on the podcast of the same name. I'm now watching that on Apple TV, and it's very funny and very moving. Georgia also published a memoir this year, My Mess is a Bit of a Life, which looks back at her writing life, but also at how severe anxiety has affected her through the years and how she's eventually come to confront it. It's not a conventional memoir. It's written in very short chapters, sometimes less than a page long. So it has the feel of a series of little sketches, and it has some very funny moments and some utterly heartbreaking moments. And I just think it shows what a light touch she has as a writer. I interviewed Georgia remotely in November, and apologies for any moments where the sound quality is not as good as it should be. It's just an ongoing problem of COVID precautions and wanting to speak to brilliant people who aren't always available to talk face to face. But I've done my best to mitigate it, and I think Georgia is so likeable and so honest about her work that I think the interview makes up for any sound of hoovering that you might notice at one point in the background. She talked to me about what it was like to spend the first 25 years of her career working only with male writers, what she learned about quality swearing from The Thick of It, and how they apply comedy writing principles to serious drama on Succession. This week's episode is sponsored by Scribe Lounge, a free online community platform for UK screenwriters. Scribe Lounge is a dedicated space that allows screenwriters to interact with over 1,000 like-minded creatives. Whether you're a complete beginner embarking on your first screenplay or a bona fide professional with hours of TV under your belt, Scribe Lounge provides an opportunity to ask questions, share your experience, and exchange support and encouragement with your peers. As well as the free community, Scribe Lounge offers a pro membership where, for a monthly or annual fee, writers can take their work to the next level. Attend monthly writing groups, script chat sessions, and exclusive Q&As with industry professionals. Previous guests include screenwriter and author David Nichols, Sky Drama Commissioner Paul Gilbert, and Four Screenwriting course leader Philip Shelley, all of whom are included in over 30 hours of Q&A playback. Founded by professional screenwriter James Capel, Scribe Lounge is an essential writing resource. Visit scribelounge.com to find out more and sign up today. But now, over to Georgia.
Really, I write anywhere. I quite like writing amidst the sort of kerfuffle and chaos of family life. But I suppose I'm in the room. I've just moved recently, and for the first time in my life, I have an office. So I'm in that, which was kind of, it's an odd sentence to say, but since the pandemic, you know, I trying to have Zooms and my children homeschooling in the same room was not working. So I now, yeah, for the first time in my life, I have an office. I wish you could see it. It's very exciting to me.
Would you describe it for me?
Well, it's quite small, and there's a very large cow in it, very multicoloured cow, which is a sort of souvenir from a thing I was filming recently called The Shrink Next Door. It's a kind of key prop. And then there's a lot of, I suppose, apart from books, there's just, yeah, I suppose a lot of little souvenirs from things I've filmed, which is very nice to have, because I think television is so sort of intangible, isn't it? You know, if you write a book, you have a book to show for it, but often you write something and it appears on television and you're not sure if that's actually happened or you've imagined it. So it's quite nice to have something, you know, a prop or two from the show that you can actually look at and touch, and brings back all the nice memories.
Definitely. Would you tell me a bit about some of the props that you've got in there?
So I've got quite a lot of fun stuff from Veep. I got very overexcited when I finally got to the stage where I would have a chair with my name on it. So now I've now got quite a few. I've taken the chair back, so I've got quite a few. My ambition is to be able to have a whole table's worth of chairs with my name on them. So I've got a few of those, and then sort of little kind of supposedly things from the White House from my time on Veep, and then some kind of notebooks that say Waystar Royko from Succession.
Oh wow.
And just the kind of little bits and pieces that I've pilfered from sets, obviously with permission. It's a little collection of ephemera.
Are you writing anything at the moment?
I am, yes. I always like to write on lots of things at once because I find it really helps, actually. It means you don't get writer's block, because if you get stuck on something, you just jump onto something else. So I'm changing another podcast into a TV show. So The Shrink Next Door, which is just coming out next week, that was a podcast which I adapted to a television show, and that was really, I really enjoyed that. And now I'm adapting a podcast called Tunnel 29. Did you hear that one?
No, I didn't. I heard The Shrink Next Door, but...
Oh, did you? Yeah. Mm. Tunnel 29 is a great podcast, another true story about these engineering students in Germany in 1961 who used their very rudimentary understanding of engineering to dig a tunnel under the Berlin Wall into East Berlin and rescue lots of people from East Berlin.
Oh wow.
So that's pretty exciting, and I think Johann Renck, who directed Chernobyl, is going to direct that.
Gosh.
And then I'm writing something for Julie Louis-Dreyfus, because since Veep we've been trying to find something to do together. So I had an outrageous idea for her, so we're working on that. And then did you read that great book, Eleanor Oliphant?
I haven't. I know of it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, so I'm hoping to adapt that. And then I'm involved in this crazy scheme to turn the life story of Grayson Perry into a musical.
Oh wow. God, you're working on so many interesting things.
Yeah, it's fun. It's and so different as well. It's like they're all different mediums, and you know, some are kind of silly and funny and others are quite serious. So I love writing, so and I enjoy writing anything, but these, I'm really excited about these projects.
Would you tell me a little bit about how you work in terms of, I mean, I've had so many guests on this podcast who have children, and they say, you know, the idea of a writing routine is sort of laughable when you have a family, because you're fitting it around everything. But if you could just sort of describe a bit how you come to sit down and work, and what works best for you as a sort of process.
Yes, I don't really have a sort of system or a particular process. As you say, I just kind of do it when I can, and I think, and I don't mind where, you know, I can write anywhere with any amount of noise. I find it really important. You know, if I don't do it every day, I feel sad. So I just make sure I do some writing every single day, and as much as life will allow me. And I've been doing that. I think, you know, it's the one thing I've never been confused about, that I always knew from before I could write that I wanted to be a writer. So I would, as a child, sort of record stories into a tape recorder. And then, you know, as I got older, I'd write them. And then by 11, I had a typewriter and was writing. I think my first book, in heavy quotation marks, was a biography of my hamster.
you write in your book about sitting with your grandpa while he was writing, because he wrote short stories, is that right?
Yes, yeah.
Do you think that was quite formative, seeing him at work on that?
I think it really was, yeah. There was something, he lived in a pretty chaotic household, and there was something very sort of calm and peaceful about watching him work. And I think I saw then that it could be something that was not only, you know, incredibly creatively fulfilling, but also something that could be a bit of a sort of lifeline, or an oasis, or a sort of, you know, something almost therapeutic, you know, that not just something you like doing, but something you kind of need to do.
Mm. And how did you get your start as a professional writer?
Well, it was tricky because, you know, having said I always knew I wanted to write, I couldn't quite work out how I was going to make that happen, because I knew I couldn't write like a novel, because I'm not very good at prose, and I don't know enough adjectives, and I hate describing things. It feels like too much of a responsibility to decide how something looked. Who am I to say what the sunset looked like? You decide. And I knew I couldn't be a journalist, because I just don't care about facts, and not, I think I'm too lazy to research. And so I couldn't think what I was going to do. And then I realised that I was one of those my mum, who's good at pointing out my faults, noticed that I was one of those very annoying people who would watch sort of comedy shows or sketch shows or stand-up and memorise the dialogue and recite it in a deeply irritating way. And so she sort of said, maybe dialogue's your thing. And so that kind of was a moment of epiphany, and I thought, yes, that's exactly right. So I started years ago. There was a show called Weekending. I don't know if other writers you've talked to have worked on that, which was a sort of Radio 4 kind of comedy show about the week's news, and it had this amazing kind of sort of open door policy that once a week anyone could go into the BBC and sit with the producer and hear what subjects they were going to be covering. And a lot of people in those rooms, I think, were just basically homeless and keeping warm. But I went along, and you got £8 a joke. So I managed to get my first sort of work broadcast on that show. And it was exciting.
Do you remember what the jokes were, your first few?
They weren't very good. My first one, I think, was a joke about Marks and Spencers and their profits, or their figures not being very good. And there was some joke about taking them back and exchanging them for something else. and then if you had an actual sketch on, you got like £21 a minute. And if you went into the second minute, you got a whole other £21. And so the show would go out, I think it was like on a Friday at 11 o'clock, and I was living with my brother at the time, and we didn't have a radio except for in his 2CV. So I remember just in winter going out at 11 o'clock at night to sit in his freezing 2CV and listen to the radio with a stopwatch. And, you know, if I went over 1 minute, it was just like, yes, I can eat this week. So yeah, that was exciting because you never knew till the show went out if you'd been successful or not.
I'm going to have to sort of skim quite quickly through your CV because you've worked on so many interesting things. But there was a bit in your, when I was reading your memoir, I was sort of frantically turning down pages, things that I wanted to ask you about. But there was a bit where you mentioned you were working on Have I Got News For You for a bit in the 90s. You said, the handy thing is I didn't have to bother with imposter syndrome because as a woman who didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge, I was treated like an imposter. What was it like being a female TB writer in the 90s? I mean, that's assuming that it isn't still like this, but you can tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I was listening to one of your other episodes and didn't you have a writer who was saying there were two women in the room, I think?
Yeah, Christine Rose, yeah.
Yeah, oh my gosh, I was so excited when I heard that. Yeah, it was, well, I mean, it's all I knew. So on the one hand, it seemed completely normal to be the only woman in every room. But I must say, I did think that it would quickly improve, and it was 25 years before I worked with another woman, and that was actually in the States. And you know, I love all the men I work with; they're absolutely fantastic, and I think there's a special bond that comedy writers have because we're all sort of consumed with self-loathing. So. but yeah, it was extraordinary when I did. So I didn't really know what I was missing. And when I then worked with two other women, so there were three of us in the room, ridiculous. But it was so amazing. It really did blow my mind. It was so pathetically validating to sit opposite people who looked a bit like you and dressed a bit like you and had the same kind of life experiences and references and, you know, I imagine that's what it's like being a white man every single minute of every day when you walk in any room or turn on the TV, and it's great.
Yeah.
Because it's really good for your self-esteem, and it's, you know, and there are still so many people in the world who never see themselves represented, you know, on screen in any important role. Mm. Or in other walks of life, and it is really hard. So in a way, working with these other women was kind of brilliant, but it also made me realise what I'd been missing. And you know, when I go back to being the only woman again now, it's sort of harder because I know what it could be like.
I mean, you say it wasn't until, you know, 25 years in when you were working in America that you worked with other female writers. What was going on Smack the Pony then? Because
yeah, you
know, I absolutely loved Smack the Pony.
Yes.
You would imagine that it would be a sort of haven for women. But
oh, it was a haven for women. Yes, I should sort of have a little sort of asterisk saying I mean writers only. So I've worked with some fantastic writer performers, and everyone I worked with on Smack the Pony who was female was a writer performer. So, you know, obviously Dune and Sally and the other Smack the Pony actors, and then people like Faye and Oriane who were writer performers. But I feel that's a slightly different thing. Maybe I'm being too nerdy and writery, but I just think it's different being a writer only than being a writer performer, because I perhaps in a massively reductive and simplistic way feel that writer performers are performers first, or that's what they like doing most.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm being unfair or just wrong, but certainly in the last few years where there have been more shows with women in the lead, they tend to have been written by writer performers, and that comes from a place, you know, if you think of Sharon Horgan or Phoebe Waller-Bridge or Michaela Cole, you know, that all those examples came from a place of them feeling people, well, they weren't getting good enough roles, or people weren't writing them good enough roles. And so they wrote them themselves. So although that's brilliant and their shows were brilliant, it came from a place of you know, to put it baldly, discrimination. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's great that they do that, and what amazing shows they are when they happen, and how enriching they are for all of us, and how much better TV and film is when we hear from all kinds of voices, from, you know, men and women and people of all ages and class and race and culture and, you know, everything. It's just so much more interesting to hear these diverse stories than keep hearing stories written by white men who've been to Oxford. And, you know, I know lots of those, and they're very talented and they've got some good stories to tell, but they've, you know, I think it's great to hear some other types of stories. And so I have worked with, I did work with some writer performers, not many, really. Smack the Pony was it. Mm. But yeah, I hope it's changing now, slowly. Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you a bit about working with Armando Iannucci. Which you did on The Thick of It and again on Veep. And sort of as a fan and a, you know, layperson, I would imagine that, you know, working with Armando Iannucci must be a sort of masterclass in writing good dialogue. And those shows, I mean, I love Veep, but The Thick of It has a special sort of place in history, I think, for just being quite different to anything that had come before. Did it feel sort of like that? Do you think you learnt anything about dialogue on that show? I know you were already very experienced by the time you got there, but
absolutely, it was life-changing, definitely. And it was terrifying. I was so in awe of him, and so when I got asked to write for The Thick of It, I was so excited and so scared. And I turned up on set the first day that I was working there, and they used to film it in this weird abandoned office building in, I think it was Walton-on-Thames, somewhere sort of out of the way. And I walked in and he said, right, so we're going to be writing, there's this inquiry happening, and the vibe I'm going for is sort of less Chilcot, more Leveson. Okay, so off you go.
Oh, God.
And I just sort of had, I was just, this sort of wave of panic washed over me, because I mean, I just about heard of Leveson, but I thought Chilcot was some lovely spa that I wanted to go to. And I just thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? And there was no Wi-Fi in this weird abandoned office building, so I couldn't even Google what the hell is Chilcot. But I did seriously sort of look out the window and think, shall I just run and keep running and never come back? But then I sort of thought, right, I understand the word inquiry, and I understand that all these characters are going to be being asked difficult questions, just as I've been asked to do a difficult thing. So I can channel this terror, and it's, so it worked out quite well, because I sort of channeled the terror, and I just thought, well, all these characters are going to be lying. And I think it's interesting, when you write someone lying is often when you really get to their truth. So actually it ended up being a really exciting day. So I'm glad I didn't run away and move to Panama and start a new life, because it was okay in the end.
And what about all those sort of one-line insults from The Thick of It that, you know, you also see in Veep, and I think you also, I want to come on to this later, but I think you also see in Succession. But so what is the craft of one of those, and do you feel like you got better at them from doing those shows?
I do, actually, yes. I remember thinking very primly when I was asked to work on The Thick of It, well, I don't think I know enough swear words. And then again, Armando sort of asked me to do a sort of a Malcolm Tucker diatribe, and it all came pouring out of me, this torrent of filth. It was astonishing. And I think, you know, the sort of sensibility, if you can use that word about swearing, was, you know, to make it rather sort of baroque and elegant and creative and flowery, not just have people you know, saying fuck you to each other. And I think that's the real difference. And I think it was a big shock, I think, when Veep first appeared in the States. I think it was unlike anything they'd seen. And I think the difference was not really using swearing as an aggressive insult, but using it as a sort of descriptive tool. And I think that's the difference, is, you know, people used to say, certainly my nan said to me, swearing isn't big and it isn't clever. And now I want to say to him,
beg to differ. Yeah,
yes, it is. My whole career has been built on it. But, you know, people, you know, sometimes say it's lazy. And I think we were trying to do the opposite of that. You know, instead of just using one or two words instead of a more interesting adjective, we tried to be very imaginative and creative and make it, make the description more interesting rather than less interesting by employing some unexpected and unusual words. And that was a good lesson to learn.
Yeah, I was really happy to see that you talked in the book about a particular scene of Veep, which I think is maybe the best scene of Veep, which is the scene where Selena finds out that she is suddenly going to be made president, and she goes into this public toilet, I think it is, and Gary goes in with her to, and they're sort of processing this news, and he gets a nosebleed, and then they both get completely sort of hysterical with laughter. And I liked that scene so much that I rewound it several times and then actually Googled it to see if I could find out anything else about how it came together. I know it was your idea that Gary get a nosebleed in that scene. Does it feel like sort of alchemy seeing it go from your idea and this script that you've been working on to that final scene that we end up with?
Yes, that was a really special moment because, as I say in my book, because I'm a classic British middle class person, i.e. emotionally repressed and very unevolved and bad at expressing my feelings, one of my more attractive qualities is that when I'm sort of in moments of extreme emotion, joy or sadness, instead of crying, I have a nosebleed. It's delightful. And so when we decided this was going to happen, we just couldn't think what. We kind of knew Selena would be pleased. That seemed quite straightforward. But we just, because Gary is kind of, his devotion to her is so deep and so kind of complex and layered. We just couldn't think what he would do. You know, would he laugh? Would he cry? What would he do? And then it seemed obvious to me he'd have a nosebleed. Everyone looked a bit strangely at me when I suggested it. But, but yeah, when we sort of tried it out, we were kind of rehearsing and we did go into this sort of loo off the rehearsal room. And it just completely worked. And yeah, as you say, it was this kind of moment of alchemy where it's wonderful anyway when a suggestion really works and then not just comes to life, but when the cast kind of elevate it to a whole new level. But if it's also some sort of weird dysfunctional part of your personality, you kind of feel, oh, it's been worthwhile. There was a reason that I'm so weird. It's led to this nice moment. So yeah, so that was very pleasing.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's like that Nora Ephron quote, is it? Everything is copy. I think that's what my mother used to tell her.
Exactly.
Did you sort of feel like that after you wrote your memoir, that everything had paid off in a way?
I thought it paid off. But yeah, it was a very odd experience doing that. I still can't quite believe I did it. You know, when it was suggested to me, I sort of laughed and said, you know, the one thing we can be very certain of in this life is that I will never, ever write a memoir. And then I don't quite know what happened, really. A sort of terrible lapse in judgment, but or maybe lockdown madness. But I did indeed write something very personal, having, you know, it's so lovely being an anonymous writer and just expressing yourself through stealth, you know, putting bits of yourself in Roman in Succession or Tom or whatever. But to write something direct was really scary and strange. That I'm very private, so I think people who know me all my life sort of didn't know 80% of what was in the book. So yeah, but it's been an interesting few months.
Well, it's a very good memoir, and I think you've written it in a very, perhaps because you are so private, you've written it in a very restrained way in those little chunks, so mm-hmm. it's not as though you've opened yourself up in a kind of warts and all sort of, you know, there aren't pages and pages of outpourings about your most private feelings or anything. So I think you hit the good balance.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's not like I'm drunk going, and another thing. I tried to not bang on too much about anything and just keep it brief.
It seems to me, and I'm probably stating the obvious, that there's a bit of a through line from The Thick of It and Veep to Succession. And I think that what makes Succession so special is that it feels like it's applying sort of comedy writing principles to serious drama, which is quite a sort of unusual mix. What do you think of that?
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, it started that the sort of core group that started on Succession were basically British comedy writers, scruffy, shambolic British comedy writers. And I think there was some trepidation felt on by some people about whether a group of British comedy writers could pull off an American drama. And in some ways we couldn't, which I'll come to later. But on the other hand, I think exactly what you say is right, that you know, when you are a comedy writer, you're so used to making every word count and to the sort of rhythm of the dialogue and the pace and the economy of it. And I think, you know, we brought that sort of approach to a drama so that, you know, we really do work on every single word. And I think often we're terrible at stage directions. That's the thing about comedy. When you meet an American drama writer, they do pages of the most incredible, beautifully written stage directions, like The Great American Novel or something. But, you know, sometimes the dialogue is sort of less beautifully written in a way than the stage directions. You know, they're so into sort of the visuals and what's happening internally. And I think what a bunch of sort of socially inadequate British comedy writers brought to it was, it's all in the dialogue. There's no beautifully written stage directions. We're not going to tell you what's going on internally. We're just going to reveal or conceal that by the dialogue. And I think that's right. It has, our sort of background did kind of ultimately help us.
Mm. Is it in the stage directions that Roman never seems to sit on a chair in a normal way, or is that just something that...
No, that's just Kieran. He's like that. Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I love that. He's so good. And then the way in which we failed was that, you know, none of us had a clue what it was like to be rich. So we had to get these rich consultants on to help us, and they really gave us a hard time. I remember them sort of saying to us, you know, what are you doing? That rich people don't have coats. They just go from their car to their jet to their building. They don't wear coats. And then in my in the first season, I wrote the Thanksgiving episode, and I'd written ridiculous things like sort of Marsha saying, I'm cooking a turkey, or let's sit down and eat, or something. And they were like, oh my God, she wouldn't even know where the kitchen was. She wouldn't sink so low as to say what was being cooked or when it was time to eat, you know. And I think I'd written that the staff was sort of in maid's uniform. I don't know. I was basing it either on porn or old racist episodes of Tom and Jerry. I don't know what staff look like. And they were like, no, they'd be in chinos and polo shirts. And then I think I put that the napkins were in serviette rings because that seemed really posh to me. And they basically sort of said I was trailer trash and knew nothing. But so, yeah, there were ways in which we didn't pull it off. But luckily, people came to our aid and helped us.
What is a rich consultant? You know, what background are these people from? Are they people who've worked with the Uber, you know, did they work on yachts or something? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. I must find out, actually. They just did seem to know all the rich people in America and know how they lived their lives. It was really fascinating. We had this sort of funny sort of stalemate almost with this rich consultant who came to the writer's room. We were in Brixton and we were talking about how quite often in rich, very super rich families, certainly in media owning families, they quite often sue each other, you know, parents suing children and vice versa. And he was explaining some people he'd known who did this, and we were saying, but you know, why did she sue her dad? And he was saying, well, you know, she'd been given £70 million, but she wanted another 70, you know, that she, there was a way she could get another 70 million. And we were just, but why would you need another 70 million? And he was just, but it's 70 million. We were just like, yeah, but why? And he was like, because it's 70 million. And we were just like, but why? And it was just like we were speaking a different language. He was looking at us as though we were insane. And we were just like, you know, we were still at the stage where we were so excited that HBO was paying for our prep sandwiches that we couldn't conceive of why you might need more than £70 million or dollars.
How do you go about adapting a podcast to turn it into a film or a series? Is The Shrink Next Door a series or is it a film?
It's a series, yeah. It's 8 episodes, yeah.
Yeah, and now you're doing another one. Are there any sort of special challenges to that?
Well, The Shrink Next Door was the first time I'd written about real people, unless you count Spice World.
Which I do, so...
if you can count them as real people. But yeah, so Shrink Next Door had some specific sort of challenges and responsibility, really. But I think, you know, it, in a way, as you were saying, there's a sort of line from The Thick of It to Veep to Succession. I think that continues really to Shrink Next Door because, as you know from listening to it, but others might not know, it's the story of a man who goes to see a psychiatrist in New York in the 80s, and then over the course of 27 years the psychiatrist takes over his business and moves into his house and takes all his money. And I just thought it would be too easy to do this as a sort of goody and baddie story or victim and villain story, you know, a bit like Dirty John, which was another podcast that was changed into a TV show. You know, I didn't want to do a thing where you say, right, here's the goodie, here's the baddie, let's wait until, it's going to be really annoying while we wait for the goodie to work out that the baddie's a baddie. I hope I'm not blinding you with science here, Hattie, with my technical jargon, my sophisticated take on things. Yeah, so I thought, I don't want to do that. And it felt like it would be more interesting if the viewer went on that journey with Marty, the patient. So while the podcast was very much told from Marty's point of view, the patient's point of view, I thought, I want to show this, to sort of let the story unfold without kind of judgment or blame on both the characters' parts. You know, I don't want to say that Ike, the psychiatrist, is evil or a monster. And I don't want to say that Marty is gullible or a fool. I want to say these are two intelligent men. And how did this happen? You know, this is a tragedy for both men. And sort of just let the viewer go on that ride with Marty, where you kind of meet Ike, who's played by Paul Rudd. So it's very easy to be sort of charmed and swept off your feet by him. And you know, he improves Marty's life. And, you know, as time goes on, there are a few little alarm bells ringing or red flags, but because it's Paul Rudd, he just wins you round again, and you keep thinking, oh, it's probably fine. And so I just thought it would be much more interesting and much more lifelike. We've all had relationships, whether with family members or friends or romantic relationships, that start well and then go wrong. And I think it's very difficult to pinpoint where it goes wrong, and it's very easy to just ignore those sort of warning signs and just hope for the best or trust people or you know, think it's going to be all right. And that felt like a sort of an interesting approach. And I suppose that's, you know, thinking of Thick of It and Veep and Succession, I seem to enjoy writing for people who on the surface are perhaps not likeable or even irredeemable, and just try to find the humanity and sort of try to find compassion or understanding for why they behave the way they do.
I can't wait to see that. It sounds so good.
Yeah, it's fun. Well, I must say, Will Ferrell, I mean, I've always loved him and thought he was hilarious, but he gives such an incredible, I mean, a very straight performance, so heartbreaking, so nuanced. I think everyone's going to be amazed. He's I hadn't really appreciated what an incredible actor he is.
Is there anything you find particularly difficult as a writer?
Well, I've mentioned my inability to do research. So for example, in Succession, the business stuff I find very difficult. We've got a business consultant as well. So it's a bit like doing an exam. I can keep the information in my head for as long as we're writing. And then once it's over, if you ask me now to explain what a sort of proxy vote is or a bear hug or something, I wouldn't be able to. So, yeah, I think it when it gets on to sort of tricky technical stuff, I find that difficult. Mm. I'd just much rather write Roman jerking off in the bathroom while Jerry insults him.
I'd rather see that, so please keep going with that. Okay. I love that whole dynamic. It's just so funny and sort of weirdly poignant, actually. I'm finding it increasingly poignant, the way Roman treats Jerry.
I know, I love him, because he's really the only character who loves anyone, isn't he? He loves his dad, he loves his siblings, he loves Jerry. I adore Roman.
Can you think of anything that you've learned along the years, any sort of specific tips that you've received or realisations you've come to that have really improved your writing?
I think Armando taught me a lot when it comes to sort of team writing, which, you know, is really what we did on The Thick of It and Veep, and also what we do on Succession. So he sort of uses this great metaphor of making a gravy, which is that, you know, he has this great approach where you write a script, but then we all add jokes to each other's scripts, and then we keep passing it around and we keep seeing the sort of alts or alternative jokes that we put down. So you might put sort of 3, 4, or 5 alternative jokes down, and then the next person does the same, the next person does the same. And so you sort of get to a place in the end that you would never have got to alone. And so he always sort of talks of it in terms of, you know, with gravy, you might throw in your carrot or your onion, and then at the end, you can't see a carrot or an onion. But if it wasn't for that, you wouldn't have the end results. So I think that's his very kind way of saying, if your joke isn't the one you see on screen, it still was sort of crucial in getting to that one that you see on screen.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And he picks such brilliant people to work with, and everyone's so sort of generous and ego-free, and it's not at all competitive. It's very supportive. And so that was a really exciting thing to learn. And then I think the other thing I've learned really is just about being kind of truthful, really. And, you know, I think for comedy and drama, it's all funnier or better if it comes from a place of truth. And comedy is as much about the jokes you don't use as the jokes you do, because it's so easy to think, oh, that's a funny joke, I'll keep that in. But if it doesn't come from character or truth, then it's not helping the script. And I think just sort of being strict with yourself and being brave enough to make everything very grounded and authentic is really important. I think that makes a huge difference to the end result.
And what, looking back over your writing life, what do you feel proudest of?
I mean, so many things. I was very, very happy to be involved with Smack the Pony, because that did feel like it changed things. And it was, you know, this was back in a time where people really did have the conversation, are women funny? Gosh. Which seems extraordinary, doesn't it? So, you know, a show that men and women enjoyed, and that wasn't what people were expecting, that was really exciting to be part of. And then I think, yeah, definitely, you know, the more recent things I've written for, where I've followed my own advice, I just said, of being truthful. I think early on in my career, I tended to write quite silly stuff, which is, you know, I still love and I'm a fan of silly stuff. And I think there's definitely, we need silly stuff. But I think, you know, since being involved in the thick of it, everything I've written has been, rather than sort of hiding behind or deflecting any attention by just, you know, throwing out silly jokes, I think doing this sort of more honest stuff that comes from the heart, I feel very proud of, because it's scary, and so it's very lovely when it works. So yeah, the thick of it and Veep and Succession and now The Shrink Next Door, I'm really proud of.
A big, big thank you to Georgia Pritchett for that chat, which I loved. Do seek out all of her shows if you haven't seen them already, particularly The Shrink Next Door, which is on Apple TV now. And you can find her memoir, My Mess is a Bit of a Life, in the InWriting shop at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing. That's also in the show notes. This episode is sponsored by the online community platform Scribe Lounge. If you're an aspiring or professional screenwriter and you want to ask questions and share your experience in a safe and supportive space, join Scribe Lounge for free today at scribelounge.com. I've seen some really lovely reviews of the podcast this past week, and there's no way for me to know who they're from or say thank you directly. So I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who has been and continues to be so supportive of this series. See you next week.